Thanks to all of you for this very warm welcome. And it's such a delight to be here with you tonight and see all of you there online. And I think we have a lot of need for the Dharma at this time. And so I feel inspired to, especially to be with groups that have been carrying it on for many years, like yours has. So let's share the Dharma together. I wanted to start with a story about one of the people in the Pali Canon. You may have heard of him. His name was Anathapindika. And if you haven't, it's okay because I'm about to tell the story about him, which is that he was one of the wealthiest donors to the Sangha at the time of the Buddha in a city named Savatthi. And he was, kind of like a local well-known person and really loved supporting the Buddha and his followers every time they came through. And he, in fact, he spent three-fifths of his fortune to build a monastery for the Buddha. And then sort of on, just out of inspiration. But then one-fifth of his wealth was washed away into the sea. That's what it says. And that the other one-fifth had been lent, but the person didn't repay it, even though they said they would. And so he quite suddenly found himself poor, even though he had previously been very wealthy. But nonetheless, the quality of dana, wanting to give in his heart, was unaffected by all of this. And so even though he was poor, he continued to invite the Buddha and his monks to come, even though all he could serve them was thin rice gruel, whereas he used to be able to give them, full meals and other things. So that was kind of a, we'll get back to him, so I won't leave you hanging. But that story is told in the commentaries about him. And he appears in a number of teachings also in the suttas. So, of course, we know that material wealth is unreliable in some sense. We're not surprised too much by that. And we know that material wealth can be hard to get. It can be easy to lose. And it's subject to many forces over which we don't have very much control when we really think about it. The Buddha even mentioned a number of common ways in which our wealth is lost. And he named fire, flood, kings, thieves, and hateful heirs. How about that? So you might recognize some of these from our modern world. And I think it's fair to say that many spiritual traditions remind people of this unreliability. And also talk about various kinds of inner wealth that are not only more reliable, but also inherently more valuable than the usual kind of conventional kind of wealth that we think about. And the Buddha was among those. He talked about this quite a bit in his very first teaching when he talked about the Four Noble Truths, which was the rolling forth of the wheel of Dharma. That sutta, he mentioned that pursuing a material-oriented life is, he gave it a Pali word, anatta samhito, which means possessed of non-benefit. Possessed of non-benefit. And some translators have translated this word, therefore, as unprofitable. So I kind of liked that. I mean, there's many other ways. You could just say not unbeneficial. That's fine too. But some have actually said unprofitable, which means that when one engages in this way of thinking or this view of life, kind of a get what I can, I want to get as much material wealth as I can or and as much pleasure, that actually diminishes the mind. We get less out than we put in if we go through life with that kind of attitude. And so the implication then, kind of the converse of that, is that if we don't live that way, and if we live by the Eightfold Path, which is what the Buddha names as the contrast, then living by the Eightfold Path would be profitable or beneficial, but I'm kind of using profitable because we're on the wealth concept here. So the material world may seem to bring profit at times, it does, but over the long haul, frankly speaking, it's a lot of ups and downs, and it doesn't bring the deeper benefits that we get from spiritual practice, which I think many of us have realized in our lives. So if we follow the Eightfold Path, then our mind comes out better than it went in. We get out more than we put in. And so there's this sense of profit. So there's a sutta. So with that kind of as a backdrop, I want to talk about a sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya that is simply entitled Wealth, the teaching that the Buddha gave on wealth. And in it, it gives five qualities. It names five qualities that constitute this kind of true wealth or inner wealth that is more reliable than the outer kind. And I'll name them first, and then we'll talk about them a bit and also some implications of that. So they are confidence, virtue, learning, generosity, and wisdom. And then there's this set of five actually appears in a number of places. The Buddha seemed to like talking about it. And one of the other places that he talked about it, he calls them fortifications of the mind. Things that will fortify us or make us strong in our mind and heart and spirit, especially at the time of death. There was actually somebody who was worried about his mind becoming deranged or becoming agitated or confused at the time of death. And the Buddha said, "Oh, don't worry. For you have cultivated these five things, and because of that, you won't have any problems when you die." So if that's of interest to you, that might also be a kind of a, yeah, an interest in this particular list. So I want to look at each of these and we'll see how they were defined in the Buddhist teachings and also talk more, kind of more contemporarily about how they can serve us and also our community or society or culture. Because each one of them is really not just an individual trait, even though we can cultivate it ourselves. So we'll start with confidence, also translated as trust or faith. I know not everyone likes the word faith, but I've come to like it. I actually use it partly because I used to be somebody who was very skeptical of the word faith and not so interested in that. And then over time, to my great surprise, that changed. So I offer that as a possibility, but it could also be confidence. So I'll just read what the language is and then we'll kind of see how it lands. And what is the wealth of faith? Here, a noble disciple, and that's all of us, is endowed with faith or confidence. They place faith in the awakening of the Buddha thus. The Blessed One is an arahant. Perfectly enlightened, accomplished in true knowledge and conduct, fortunate, knower of the world, unsurpassed trainers of persons to be tamed, teacher of devas and humans, the enlightened one, the blessed one. This is called the wealth of confidence or faith. So it can sound at first a little devotional and a little like, well, I don't really go around thinking that during the day most of the time. But note that there's a number of interesting things about it. One is that it doesn't say a person has faith in the Buddha. It says they have faith in the awakening of the Buddha. And that's kind of different. There's a sense of we have some confidence that awakening is possible because the Buddha started out a human just like us, probably had a mind kind of like ours, given that he spent the first part of his life just living in a series of castles that were, pleasant palaces, let's say, pleasant places to live, had all kinds of entertainment. I don't think his mind was that elevated during that time, although, of course, he had built up a lot of potential for that. But then he went out and decided he was more interested in non-material things and was able to awaken. Well, that's pretty good. That's good news for us. There's potential in our mind. And then there's all these wonderful things said about him, Arhant, perfectly enlightened teacher, etc. And I don't think we need to be really literal about that, but more that we have kind of a sincere acknowledgement of these higher possibilities of the heart. It's the opposite of cynicism. It's the opposite of sarcasm. It's the opposite of other ways that we diminish our own or others' potential. So we allow ourselves to be uplifted by what is truly valuable. There are other places where the Buddha says, kind of generally, there are beings who are inspired by things that are lofty. I like that. It's not meant as a kind of an elitist thing, but just this acknowledgement, this kind of sincerity about, yeah, the spiritual path goes somewhere, and we can all do that in some way. So I see that as, in our everyday life, we would have some confidence or some faith in that possibility for ourselves and for others. And so we would naturally be compassionate. We would give people the benefit of the doubt. We would respect their potential also. Imagine how the world would be if a lot of people were behaving that way. So this is a tremendously social value as well as a personal trait. That's a form of inner wealth. And then we have virtue. And again, the language is kind of nice. Here, a noble disciple abstains from the destruction of life, abstains from taking what is not given, abstains from sexual misconduct, abstains from false speech, and abstains from intoxicants, which are the basis for heedlessness. So, these are, of course, you may recognize them as the five lay precepts that we sometimes commit to for a retreat or for other times in our life. And they're all about just abstaining. It's not an obligation that we're asked to do certain things or look good all the time. It's just that, we decide, no, I don't need these particular things. And so then there are so many benefits of that. Ethical conduct immediately protects other beings, but it also protects us because it brings what's called the bliss of blamelessness, or the possibility that we know that we acted as well as we could. It doesn't mean everything goes well. Even for the Buddha, everything didn't completely go well. But we know we did our best. And so, it's fine that, things unfold as they do. We can feel good about the way we conducted ourselves as well as we could. And then maybe what's not as obvious is that virtue is a powerful condition for happiness that endures even when conditions change. So, I've found times where things were not going well or a relationship wasn't going well, and I could just feel like, okay, even though, I may lose something here or things are changing in a way I wouldn't have wanted, I know that I can carry with me this kind of inner uprightness. Okay, I'm going to be in a new situation soon, but it doesn't take away anything about that character that I've built. And that was something that I'll be able to carry with me into whatever new situation comes. And I would say in the world, we need people who are genuinely positive, genuinely have a sense of happiness about who they are and how they are. Not the fake positivity of denial or, plastic smile on your face, but genuine well-being from knowing that we care about virtue, and ethics can do that. Ethics can do that. And then there's the third quality of learning. And this one is interesting, right? It's the one that kind of doesn't fit in the list. Yeah, we get qualities of character, but why is learning sitting in the middle of this list? And sometimes it kind of gets short shrift, in the teachings of, learning, because it's something intellectual. It sounds like it might be intellectual. It sounds like it's about thought, and aren't we supposed to be letting go of thought and going beyond all of that kind of way of thinking, way of being. But it's interesting and maybe worth considering it on equal footing with the others. So it's again helpful to maybe hear the language that the Buddha said, "What is the wealth of learning? Here, a noble disciple has learned much, remembers what they have learned, and accumulates what they have learned. Those teachings that are good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end, with the right meaning and phrasing, which proclaim this perfectly complete and pure spiritual life. Such teachings as these, they have learned much of, retained in mind, recited verbally, mentally investigated, and penetrated well by view." Okay, it's kind of a mouthful, and you don't have to remember all of it, but it's basically says, I hear it as saying, knowing something about the teachings. And here we are. Look at this group. Some of you have been in this group for many years, learning, sharing the teachings, continuing to hear them, learning teachings that are good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end. It doesn't matter how long we have to learn them. It's always nice to hear the Dharma, right? And so it's there's a sense of, yeah, you just expose yourself to these teachings. And we can even recite them, we can remember them as well as we can, mentally investigated. So we're not supposed to just blindly accept them. We're supposed to consider them. Do these actually make sense? Should I try it out in my life? Penetrated well by view. So I've really looked at this. I did it. Yesterday I tried something that I read in the teachings, and lo and behold, I felt more easeful than I would have been otherwise. All of this is encouraged. We're supposed to engage with the teachings, make them our own, question them, talk about them. Could it really be that studying the teachings and using them in this way has the same weight as, not killing or as generosity? How could that be? And how can learning serve other people and society, as the other four things that we're going to talk about obviously do? So I've pondered on that a bit, and maybe one way to interpret this is that putting in the effort to have a good knowledge of Buddhist teachings changes the mind in certain beneficial ways. Maybe it's not just about which teachings you've learned and how much you know, quote unquote, but maybe just that engagement of trying to learn them, trying to understand them, asking questions, talking with other people. Maybe that changes our mind in certain ways. We can also remember that back then, people didn't read. And they didn't have Zoom. So they would have had to go physically to hear teachings. And they would have had to pay enough attention that they could remember them, because they weren't getting a handout at the end or having a book or anything like that. So it was kind of an active process. And doing that process, I think, helps align the mind, with what the teachings are saying. If you go and you have to really engage and think about it, a person would start to have what could be called maybe a mind of Dharma, that would start to see life events or circumstances in terms of the teachings. And that is really beneficial. And we do get that also, even though we have books and other means. We don't have to be quite as sharp and active as someone in that time would have, but it soaks in. And this is beneficial because then we're more likely to respond in line with the Dharma. We're more likely to have, in a moment of uncertainty about what to do, maybe one of those teachings will pop into your mind. Maybe this has happened. I know somebody who was, this happens to me a lot, but my favorite example is someone who was washing a teacup in their sink, and the cup broke. They dropped it in the sink or something, and it broke. And the first thing that popped into her mind was that quote from Ajahn Chah, where he one time held up his teacup and said, "For me, this cup is already broken," indicating that he understands it's impermanent. So when her teacup broke in the sink, her mind said, "Ah, it's okay, the cup was already broken." It was already broken. As soon as it was made, it was destined to be broken. And here it is, it happened. Isn't that better than saying a four-letter word or getting angry when the cup breaks? So I think it's when we've steeped ourselves, even just gone weekly to a Dharma session like this, there starts to be this inner connection to the teachings. So they can come up for us. And then we could also say that learning in this way supports the clarity and the integrity of the other four qualities we're talking about: confidence, virtue, generosity, and wisdom. Those are all supported and clarified by learning, so that we're not confused about what they are. So then, this is valuable because, we're more likely, as I said, to respond in line with the Dharma. And when it's appropriate, we may be able to give counsel to other people also. Even if someone's not a Dharma practitioner, a friend may come with some challenge, and we don't have to say, "Well, let me tell you about what the Buddha would say about that." We could, without that kind of definiteness, we could help our friend though in some way. We could point them toward compassion or metta. We could say, "Oh, it seems like you're really caught up in this particular way of seeing it." And then they would realize, "Oh, yeah, you're right. There are other ways I could see this." So there are times where our learning supports others by us helping them to turn their mind towards something dharmic, even without, stealth dharma, as it's called, even without them being practitioners. So learning, I think, is maybe an underappreciated resource in terms of supporting our mind and the people around us. And then there's the fourth one, is generosity. And it says here, a noble disciple dwells at home with a heart devoid of the stain of miserliness, freely generous, open-handed, delighting in relinquishment, devoted to charity, delighting in giving and sharing. And so needed at this time, right? At a time when the forces in the world are pointing us toward holding in, toward narrowing, toward turning away from others. This quality is exactly what's needed in a time of scarcity, mental scarcity, let's say, or mental, I don't know, mental pulling in. The tendency is just to go along with that and hold on and withdraw and say, "Yeah, that's right, I will just care about me." But in fact, it's exactly the opposite movement that's beneficial at times like this. Generosity helps us give even when we feel like we don't have much to give, or even when we feel like we're being pinched in some way. Think back to the story at the beginning of Anathapindika, who lost all of his wealth, suddenly found himself in a very different situation, but it was his specialty. He liked giving, so he continued to offer alms, even though he had almost nothing to give. That was just because it was a quality of character. He wasn't giving because he had so much. It was like, "Well, I can give because I'm wealthy." He gave from his heart because that's what he wanted to be doing. And then the fifth quality is wisdom. And the language says here, a noble disciple is wise. They possess the wisdom that discerns arising and passing away, which is noble and penetrative and leads to the complete destruction of suffering. So it's interesting. Buddhist texts often equate wisdom with seeing impermanence or inconstancy. And we don't need to go into a long understanding of why that's selected as kind of being the epitome of wisdom. But maybe for the purposes now, we can, thinking about qualities as inner wealth, why is being able to see things changing a form of inner wealth that we have? I would say that people who pay attention to how so many things in life arise and change and pass, people like that are more able to be able to handle surprises and shocks. People who have a sense of the flow of life, things come and go. They can stay calmer when there are big shifts, such as what we're in the midst of currently. And that could refer to any number of things, right? Social unrest, environmental stress, a changing political scene. If we have a kind of a grounding in our being of, you know what, things arise and change and pass, we can't expect that things will be the same. More likely, it doesn't mean you have to like what's going on and just say, all right, great, it's all fine. But at least we'll have a basis of saying, you know what, this was expected. Things are always going to change. Where can I put my energy? What do I want to be doing now? How can I bring forth these other forms of inner wealth, confidence, virtue, generosity, using my knowledge of the Dharma? All of that is more stable when we have the wisdom of knowing that things change. So even with all the things that are going on within the world, I've reflected, it actually caused me to go and reflect a bit on these qualities. And I can say that I am certain that these five forms of inner wealth have not diminished in me, despite everything that's going on externally. In fact, there's a different sutta where the Buddha points out that these, I said they were used in a number of cases. There's yet another case where the Buddha points out that these five qualities are a type of wealth that can't be taken away. Somebody else could not take them from you. Only you can allow your virtue, for example, to decline. Only you can allow your generosity to decline. Nobody can take that from you. So be inspired, be buoyed up by the degree to which these qualities are in your heart, and know that they're secure, they're more reliable than other forms of wealth or other forms of the way we thought the world was. So I think these five have great potential on the path. They can be built and strengthened, and they can be done, that can be done even under adverse conditions. And then they partake of the path to awakening. So then I want to shift slightly and bring in a modern idea here that maybe adds some new dimension to, or some different life to the Buddha's teaching of the Four Noble Truths, of inner wealth, and of these big changes that can happen in the external world. And that is the teaching, if we could call it a teaching, let's just call it an idea, called anti-fragility, which is a term that was coined by Nassim Taleb. And he said that something is anti-fragile if it has the possibility of growing or developing in the face of challenge. And sometimes something that's anti-fragile actually needs challenge, and it will wither away or become weaker if it doesn't have any challenge. So it's not that everything in the world is like this. There are plenty of teacups in the world that are fragile. And if you drop them, they will break and you can't put them back the way they were. But what about things that are anti-fragile? It's interesting, I think, to consider that the mind and the heart at times can exhibit anti-fragility. And there are ways in which when we are challenged in some way, there can be growth or development. In fact, it might be that the Noble Truths, the Four Noble Truths, suggest this because they direct us toward coming into contact with suffering. The First Noble Truth says, notice that there is suffering in the world. It doesn't say, avoid the suffering, pretend there isn't any suffering, declare all suffering to be wrong and not in line with reality. No, it says, look at suffering. In fact, turn toward suffering. Get curious. Why is there this dukkha here? What is going on with that? So the Buddha he didn't have any words like anti-fragile, but maybe we need to turn toward that, take it in, see it, engage with it. And that is what enables us to become free, to eventually let go of it, to walk the path, all the Four Noble Truths, right? So turning toward the suffering is how we walk the path. And there might, in fact, be no other way to really strengthen the mind. I think we know this from walking the path. So if we spend our life avoiding suffering the way the Buddha did before setting out on this quest, there's a way in which that feels a little unsatisfying to the heart. And maybe the Buddha to be sensed a possible weakening of his heart living the easy palace life. And that was maybe some of the impetus for him to go out and see if he could awaken his heart by connecting with his own suffering and the suffering of the world. There's a prayer that's said by Thai monks that asks for appropriate challenges. How about that? Would you pray for appropriate challenges? And what it means is they want to have difficulties that are tough enough to strengthen them without being so tough that they're, very difficult and that they can't be learned from, essentially. So to ask, could I have just enough suffering or just enough challenge that I grow, but not so much, of course, that it's very difficult. And just so you're not left hanging, I will tell you the end of the story about Anathapindika. His material wealth was eventually restored with the help of some devas, some gods. But this was, I think, a lot less important than the inner wealth he carried that came forth when his material conditions were adverse. Maybe losing his outer wealth was kind of a factor in helping him realize that these were actually all internal qualities. He was still virtuous. He was still generous. He still had total confidence in the Buddha. He didn't say, "Wait a minute, I was walking the path and being your follower. How come things went badly for me? I thought that meant I would stay rich my whole life." So anyway, all of his inner wealth came forth naturally when he had these adverse circumstances, and so he realized that was reliable. That was a reliable form of wealth for him. That was more important than his outer wealth. So I wish for all of us deep inner welfare, deep inner well-being that is independent of changing circumstances. May we all be blessed with the inner wealth of confidence, virtue, learning, generosity, and wisdom for ourselves and for the benefit of everyone around us and the world, which is so much in need of these beautiful qualities of mind. So these are some of my thoughts on inner wealth and anti-fragility for tonight. And I've left a bit of time. I think we have a little time before going to the metta. If you would like to make any comments or ask any questions about this teaching practice. Yeah, Zoe.
I just want to say what a wonderful talk, Kim. It feels like information that's new and fresh and maybe said in a different way. It was so that it was really easy to hear. And I love the part about learning said in a different way, not just about maybe studying the texts, but how just understanding Buddhism and how you can share in a certain sense with people that maybe that aren't Buddhist or practicing Buddhism. It just was
Exactly.
inspirational. So thank you so much.
Thank you. And Mary Kelly.
Yes, thank you. And the part that I mean, I liked all of it, but I just liked your observation on learning. And we have book groups here. I belong to a book group. Right now, I'm rereading Phillips' book, Dancing with Life. And I've done different programs for learning just because I like the discipline of it. And I guess one of the things that Gil had said, and I have heard it from other people, is like, you read the Dharma. And it's just kind of floats like here. It's like this, the concept. And And then if you have an opportunity, which is really nice, is you have an opportunity to discuss it with other Dharma members, and you can just like say, oh, this is a, and it's like, you know, and that's one of the things I love about the Sangha is we have different teachers, and they will bring a teaching that maybe I've heard some part of it before, but their way of presenting it is like, okay, this is another way to look at that. And I think that that's the part of learning is there's another way to see this, another way to look at it. And then I guess Philippa talks about it too, and Gil Franzel, and then I think, trying to think of somebody else said, then you're actually, you sit with it, like you can meditate with it, you practice with it, you see what, you see kind of where it fits into whatever your other teachings are, for me, that's one place, but then at some point it drops in to my citta. It's there, and it becomes a kind of a default thing. So, like with your friend, it's like, you know, I may start to open my mouth in a situation. I think, maybe not. You know, my speech is not, it's not going to be there. You know, something will be there that gives me a pause and gives me, or I can hear somebody's words. I mean, I can actually hear their voice and their words, or I can just remember something and just. That teaching is now there for me, so that even if I'm maybe not being as mindful as I could possibly be, it's kind of there already in my heart. And that, to me, learning is
Nice.
so beautiful with that. And to have Dharma friends to do it with, man, that's like the best. It's the best. So thank you for that reminder.
Oh, thank you. I love the way you engage with the text. That's exactly how it can work in the best of circumstances. Anything else? Okay, well, oh, Rick.
Yes, I wanted to thank you very much for giving us the gift of these gifts of wealth. I never really looked at this in that way before, and I'm gonna have to go to the replay, and I learned a lot, and a new way of looking at things. So, you know, the Buddhism by the numbers really helps me. And so I got another five Buddhist numbers
Yeah.
that I never really looked at that way before.
Yeah. It's a, I think, an underrepresented or undertaught list of five that's very beautiful. And it's used in a number of different contexts that Buddha talked about it in different ways. So he clearly thought it was important. It's one reason I wanted to bring it forth. So yeah, inner wealth tonight. And I'm delighted that we can all share it. Thanks for your comment.
Thank you.
Isabel.
Yeah, hi Kim.
Hi.
I attend the 7 a.m. sit with Gil and you sometimes, so I so appreciate that. It's so amazing to start my day that way. So thank you for that. And I wanted to say a couple things. One of the things that struck me about the story that you told about the person that lost all their wealth and maintain their faith was it reminded me in college I had to read the story of Job, and Job, you know, he gets hit with a lot of, you know, with a lot of, you know, experiences that he didn't expect, you know, after living, you know, kind of like a very wealthy life as well. And it's very about faith as well, you know, and I loved what you said that, you know, because we can still aspire to have these things that we want in our life, but when times are tough, that we can build up some sort of resilience that makes the good times even better, you know, even so much better because they're just so much richer and deeper, I think. So I wanted to share that. And then the other thing I thought was really interesting, like everyone else said, it was just such a different, unique take on the Dharma, and One of the things we had the nuns from a, I can't remember the name of the monastery, but we had them teach one time here, and they were talking about death and how you deal with death, and I said, they said, do you have any questions? And I said, yes. I said, I'm terrified to die. I am absolutely petrified to die. And what do I do about that? And they said that what you need to focus on is how you live your life every day, so that by the time you die, you're not going to be scared anymore because you've lived such a life. And all the things that you mentioned in your talk really made me think about that. Like, if I could expound those virtues that, like every day work towards that instead of focusing on the fear that someday I'm going to hit that buzzsaw, instead of thinking about it that way, then just develop that amazing sense of, vitality and life that, that I can handle that moment of death. And your talk really reminded me of, like, specifically what I can do day in and day out. I'm not sure that the nun really told me exactly how to do that, but tonight I kind of felt like I got a little bit of a blueprint on how to do that. So that's all I wanted to
Wonderful,
share.
thank you. Beautiful. Okay, let's go with Liz, and then that'll be the last, so we have time for some metta.
Hi there. Thank you for not talking about equanimity. I don't want to say what I would feel if I and do if I heard about it one more time. So I am grateful for your t very grateful for your talk, like everyone else, and as qualities that I can cultivate that will lead to equanimity, but that. It's not, I don't want to start with equanimity. I want to work with these qualities. We'll have a long-term
Yeah,
result.
they're very immediate. And yeah, you've named the fruit of them in the long run. Beautiful. Thank you.